this Monte Carlo physics data that we can use on supervised learning for to discover what phases exist in the physical system of interest. Then I'll tell you a different class of machine learning called supervised learning and how we can use supervised learning to detect regions of criticality in the data for a given physical system. Okay, so actually just curious, who saw Anna's talk last week? Raise your hand. Okay, cool. So she gave like a really good introduction to machine learning, but I'd like to just be super brief and just say that it's a way of developing software where you don't hard code in the solution to whatever problem you want to solve, but you actually just define the task that you want to perform. Like for instance, you can define the task as, I want to input the data of some, say, image into a network, and I want to compress it down to like a lower dimensional space such that if I send someone else that lower dimensional compressed data, they can have this network and reconstruct it with some acceptable efficiency. And then you need to define a model which is able to do this task. So the model could just be some kind of, like you have to define what's going on inside, but really it's just a black box with this number of inputs and, well, this number of outputs, and then maybe for this example, someone else has the reverse. This model just needs to have the potential to do whatever task you just defined, like map an n-dimensional data vector to some smaller dimensional data vector. And most importantly, you need to define a learning procedure, which has a cost function defining how well this task of, say, for example, the data reconstruction is performed. And it updates the parameters that define this network to do the task better next time. Is everyone OK with that? Any questions? Good? OK. So if we're going to apply this to physical systems, we need some way of generating this data. And apart from the possibility that you could get data for a physical system from something like cold atoms experiments or something like that, you can also generate configurations of a physical system like an Ising model with something called Markov chain Monte Carlo. And the basic process of a Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm is that you have to initialize your configuration of your physical system. So say like you initialize some spins on a lattice, and then in a loop, you have some rule which generates a new configuration of that of the spins from the current one, and there's some probability distribution G over those new configurations given the current one. Then you have to define with what probability are you going to accept a proposed change from one state to the next. And then every few steps, you need to just take whatever measurements on the lattice spins that you care about. So maybe you'll add them all up and calculate magnetization and save that. But you want to wait for the system to equilibrate because it didn't necessarily start in a configuration that was from the equilibrium distribution. And you also want to wait for some number of loops in between these measurements because you want your configurations to be uncorrelated. Since this is a Markov process, the n plus one is generated from the n configuration. So what you do is you collect all these uncorrelated configurations of the system, which are just like, say, vectors of spins. And this is the data we want to be able to gain insight into with machine learning. So just to mention that these Monte Carlo algorithms are defined by like a choice of this rule G for generating a new state from a current one and the acceptance probability of accepting that change. But you don't need to worry about specific cases of that. And just as an example, so if you do this process for, or if you use a Monte Carlo algorithm to generate states for the 8x8 2D Ising model. You can plot the specific heat and internal energy, magnetization, and susceptibility, and you see kind of what you'd expect. There's some peak in the region that corresponds to the critical point in the limit of n goes to infinity. And with different system sizes, so this is the linear system size, this peak gets sharper and moves towards the critical point. So that's just an example of the data that I'm using. So the first thing I want to do is explain what someone else did to analyze Monte Carlo data using machine learning, because this is a really nice, simple application. So the algorithm is called principal component analysis. It's basically a map from some high dimensional space to a lower dimensional space, which means that you're compressing your data. And this works best if your data is kind of simply structured. So say there are, like in this example, there are four groups which map easily down to this 2D plane. So that compression works well. But if they were like groups that spiral around each other, PCA is a linear algorithm, and so it wouldn't do very well at separating those clusters. But basically, the idea is it rotates the high dimensional data to find the directions like these, PC1 and PC2, where the data has the most variance in the high dimensional space. And then you just pick, say, the first two or three principal components and project the data down to that space. And that's your compression algorithm. And what Li Wang did in discovering phase transitions with unsupervised learning is he applied this algorithm first to the 2D Ising model. And basically, just to show that given only configurations of the Ising model at different temperatures, this algorithm basically picked out that there's only one direction in the high dimensional data space that's important for distinguishing different temperatures. Basically, what it picked out was that you should do an equally weighted, so this is the weights and some index that runs over the input sites, an equally weighted sum of all of the spin values. So essentially, the algorithm discovered that you should compute magnetization in order to compress the data down to something like this, which, so this axis is the principal component, the first principal component here that it found, which we can interpret as magnetization. And the idea here is just that it's kind of cool to have at least the principle proven that maybe you can have an algorithm which discovers an order parameter for itself. And it can help you do physics that way. And by the way, so these are, we should interpret these as the low, the blue is the low temperature phase, and the red is the high temperature phase of the 2D Ising model. And this sparse region is just the transition that happens between them. So given this analysis, you should be able to look and say, oh, there are two phases in this model, whereas that wasn't an input to the algorithm. And then he applied this to the conserved order parameter Ising model, which is a bit more complicated of a system, and found that there were actually four principal components in this system that were important. And if you plot them all against each other, so this is like 4 choose 2, right? There's six different plots you can make. And in all of them, you see there's two distinct, well, kind of distinct groupings, so maybe a high temperature phase here and a low temperature phase here. And he used that to help him create this order parameter. Well, you see the order parameter here as a function of temperature, but really it's just kind of doing the cut down here, separating the low temperature phase from the high temperature phase. Yeah, Fiona?
And you see this thing from the left when you said there's two phases, and in some of them, like, it looks like there's five phases.
Yeah, that's why, like, this is an imperfect method. And I would say that, like, in the next few slides, I And in future work, I hope to like extend this method away from just being constrained to a linear transformation on the data, because it's not necessarily the most revealing thing to do, to only be able, because that's why you have four principal components, because you're, if it's a linear algorithm, it can't compress those four components down to one, because it can only rotate in this high dimensional space of data, input data. Is everything okay so far? Nah?
So how do you choose like that there are four of them?
So basically, okay. So see these PC1 and PC2? Those are eigenvectors of the correlation matrix of your data. And the eigenvalues are basically plotted here. So there are like 1, 2, 3, blah, blah, blah eigenvalues that come with your correlation matrix. And it's basically this plotted here is the relative importance of that eigenvector. So the eigenvalue tells you how much variance there is in that direction. And so if you want to compress your data, you should choose the directions with the most variance in the high dimensional space.
And this is just some close-up cutoff.
Yeah, like if this captures, you know, 99% of the variance in the data set, then it makes sense to compress your n-dimensional vector down to just one number, which in this case, it discovered the magnetization. And then in this case, there end up being four if you do the same analysis. So an extension of this to something nonlinear is using what's called a restricted Boltzmann machine. Basically, it's a stochastic neural network that represents a probability distribution over the possible input vectors, or over the space of input vectors. Don't worry about how the model works, but just know that it only has an input. So you could input, say, a vector of spins, and there's no output. All you want to do is essentially compress this input vector to some hidden space. But the model is not necessarily meant to be an explicit compression algorithm. It just represents the probability distribution over the space of input vectors. Is that okay? Okay. So basically, the way you train it is you just have a set of say configurations of a physical system. You don't need the output that you want, like in the case of, say, supervised learning, where you input an image and it classifies a dog or a cat or something like that. There is no output for this. The way you train it is you just minimize the cross entropy between the probability distribution that is defined by this model and the one that your data set defines. Okay? And if you're wondering how this represents a probability distribution, it's just imagine that there are local fields on each neuron, and each neuron is just like a spin, and these connections are couplings between the spins. And so it's essentially just like this defines an Ising model Hamiltonian with like locally varying fields, and that defines a probability distribution, right, with like statistical mechanical normal like Boltzmann distribution. Everything okay with that? Okay. And to show that you can encode the probability distribution of a physical system into a Boltzmann machine, which is what that network was called, which I forgot to mention, sorry. So basically, we trained, these plots are reproduced from a paper that Giacomo Torle and Roger Malko wrote this year or past year. But basically, you train a Boltzmann machine to model an Ising model just by giving it or showing it Ising model configurations at different temperatures. And then you ask the Boltzmann machine to produce samples of the probability distribution that it represents. And then you can calculate observables from that. And when you do that, you see that the performance or the representative power of the restricted Boltzmann machine to model the physical system is dependent on the number of hidden units like the number of hidden units. And in the case of the 2D Ising model for 64 spins, if you have 64 hidden spins, then you can pretty much model the Monte Carlo data fairly well. So this is just to show that, you can efficiently represent a statistical system with an RBM. And it's kind of a question that we're working towards is how does this, how does the efficiency of this representation depend on having multiple hidden layers in the RBM? So you could have a deeper neural network that you model your system with, and maybe a hidden, a deep RBM is more efficient than a shallow one with the same number of parameters. And that's something that we're working towards. But just like this PCA can be used to compress data and find order parameters or phases in your system, you can also interpret the hidden units of your restricted Boltzmann machine. So this is a restricted Boltzmann machine. You input the data, and it has kind of different hidden representations as you go down this network until you get to this compressed data, which you can so you can plot this compressed data for your data set, which is shown here for the 10 by 10 2D Ising model, and basically see that this RBM also can show you that there are two distinct phases at low temperature and high temperature. Okay? And actually, this seems to do a better job than the PCA algorithm because it can both fold this over so that there's only one low temperature phase, and they needed to go to n equals 80 squared to get good separation, while this only needed to go to n equals 10 squared. So this is a method for inputting configurations of a statistical system and discovering how many phases there are in that system. OK, so the last thing I wanted to show you was how you can use what's called supervised learning or feed-forward neural networks to also try to detect a critical region in the data of your physical system. So a feed-forward neural network does the job of taking an input vector and calculating some output. Okay, so it just represents a function y of x. And that function is this, where you first take your input vector, multiply it by a weight matrix represented by all of these connections, then perform some nonlinear activation function represented by these neurons. And you basically keep doing that in layers until you get to the end. So your training data has to be, you have to have both configurations and the value of whatever function you're trying to compute on that configuration. So like you need configurations and labels for whatever function you're trying to model. And basically what you do is just you try to minimize some cost between what you know the answer should be for this function y of x and what the network thinks it is. And you just improve the weights in the network via gradient descent. And at the end of training, you should be able to apply it to data that the network has never seen before and compute y of x correctly. So that's just like how a feed-forward neural network works. OK? Is there any questions? Good? OK. So at the Winter School, what we thought of doing was you could use a feed-forward neural network to try to detect a critical region in a physical system by basically just trying to train the network to calculate the temperature that a given physical configuration was generated at. And because this map is not one-to-one, like any configuration can be generated at any temperature because the system is just like a statistical system, this process should be done with varying efficiency as a function of temperature. And this is still something that we're discussing, but the current interpretation that I have is that this task should be difficult, both like in deep in a phase, so at low temperature and at high temperature, and at a phase transition. So the error of predicting the temperature correctly given an input configuration of your spin system should be highest deep in the low temperature phase, deep in the high temperature phase, and at the critical point. And the reason that I think this is because, for instance, like if you go up to high temperatures, then all of your samples from any temperature up there is just random noise. And so you can't distinguish between them being produced at different temperatures. At low temperatures, if you go below the lowest excitation energy, for example, for the Ising model, you would expect all the states in all of those temperatures just to be all up or all down. And so it'd be hard to distinguish what temperature those states came from. And then in the critical region, you have the highest amount of fluctuations and variance in your, say, order parameter there. So there are many values of order parameter that map to roughly the critical temperature. And so it should be difficult to do this, this function compute temperature given an input configuration with high efficiency. And when you try it out, you do see a peak in the critical region, but there are some things to be suspicious of. So that's still under, I don't know, that's still in progress. Yeah. Okay, so just the outlook for these projects, and you don't have to try to read these, they're just thumbnails to remind you of like what we talked about, is that we'd like to investigate how efficiently a Boltzmann machine can represent statistical systems, and how that efficiency varies with the depth of the Boltzmann machine. I also want to develop this idea of trying to detect phases with unsupervised learning, such that the order we don't have any idea of the order parameter, and maybe we can get an idea from these algorithms. And also, I'd like to apply these to non-trivial examples, so not just the Ising model all the time. And then the last thing I want to work on is to refine this idea of detecting critical regions with feedforward neural networks, because our interpretation of this effect is not yet completely clear. Okay, so we just went over basically what Boltzmann machines are and how they can model a statistical system. That they may be useful for data compression to tell you how many phases are in a physical system without having any idea of how many phases there are or what the order parameter is, just with Monte Carlo data. Then we talked about feedforward neural networks and detecting critical regions with them. So yeah, that's what we've covered. And all of this was in collaboration and discussion with all of these people from Roger Malko's group. So thanks for listening. Question. Can't tell if you didn't understand, and I did a bad job. What's up?
So, do we know if there are applications of these techniques in cosmology?
I think that. I think that any field where there is a lot of data and the need to find order in it. Mm-hmm. There's some potential to using machine learning techniques. And also, like, a lot of the simpler machine learning techniques are way more interpretable than neural networks. Yeah. And so those are actually really valuable. Like PCA is really interpretable because it's just a linear, like it's just a rotation in your space of data. So in like fields like cosmology or in accelerated physics and stuff like that, you can use simpler machine learning algorithms and still be okay with doing like error analysis and stuff. That's like one of the big downsides to using neural networks, like, is that you can't really interpret them. It's very hard to, and like to tell what they're doing, and also to keep track of errors. which is why it's kind of okay to use them as a tool maybe to suggest to you that there are these phases in these temperatures, but maybe not a good idea to like completely trust them all the time. Like you still need to do physics. So, yeah. Anybody else? Okay, cool, thanks.
So I want to talk about the duality web in 3D and the 4D. And first I want to explain to you about the title. The duality, simply speaking, it is just two theories that are different but can describe the same physics. I will give you a more concrete definition later. And by web, I mean over the years, especially in the past 5 years, people have proposed many dualities. But most of them cannot be proven analytically. However, they turns out to be very powerful concepts in many areas. So like people are trying to understand why they are dual and yeah. So instead, people are like, we couldn't prove them. So we try to link different dualities and build a web out of them. So it's called a duality web. And a 3D is a playground for kinetic matter people, and 4D and higher physics is for high energy physics. And this is an overview. First, I will give you an example of duality. This is a very old example. And then I will give you the definition and some other examples. Then I will tell you how to make your own duality. Then in 4D, I will describe a very famous duality, then its connection with a 3D duality and how we can apply this idea to understand better about dualities. To clarify some notations, phi and phi hat is some complex scalar field. All of the lowercase B, A, something like that, dynamical U1 gauge field, and the uppercase is background U1 gauge field. To those who may not be familiar with the terminology, like dynamical means is the field we integrate over in the path integral formalism. So the partition function is left with a function of the background field. And if we have a chain symmetry term in our theory, because the coupling of the chain symmetry term is quantized, so we call it a level. It's a level K chain symmetry term. And small f is the field strength corresponding to A, and the big F is for the uppercase field. Oh. The one player of this duality is called O2 model. This is very simple. We learned this in STEMEC. And we have three phases. When like B is always larger than zero. And when A is larger than zero, this U1 global symmetry is unbroken. The phi is massive. When A is smaller than zero, it's more interesting. We have we can write phi in this way. And like imagine the maxing hat. Like because the continuous U1 gauge symmetry is broken, U1 global symmetry is broken, so we have a Goldstone mode sigma, it's massless. And we can also find a vortex excitation like this, and it's quantized. And remember the important result, the energy between vortices are logarithmically divergent. And when A is zero, it is a critical point. Oh, it's not very accurate. When A is zero, we need to do the RG flow of B to find the critical point. We've learned another different model. It's called Abelian-Higgs model. It's in the tutorial of standard model. And in their theory, we have a, like before I talk about the different phases in their theory, let's first look at the symmetry. We have the U1 gauge field, which is a gauged version of previous U1 global symmetry. The conservative curvature is this one. And we have a less obvious conserved current. It's this one. I'm still not comfortable with this. It's conserved, obviously, because of like this one. It's DF. DF is a Maxwell equation. So somehow it's very trivial. It's conserved just by Maxwell equation. But we are working in a three-dimensional. So it's not trivial anymore because this G is proportional to dA. What is dA? dA is the flux. So this current is actually the current of flux. And for some reason, which will be clear later, it's called global U1 symmetry. And when A is bigger than zero, it's called a Coulomb phase. It's just your own electromagnetism. U1 gauge field is unbroken. We have the massive particle. Here, this massive particle is a boson. The electrical force between the boson is actually logarithmically divergent. So we call it confined. The reason for that is, like, remember in this morning's lecture, for two-dimensional QED, the electric potential is linear in R, right? And in three dimension, the potential is log of R, and in four dimension, it's 1/R. So, like, since the energy is log of R, we call it confined. And we also have a massless photon. Remember, we are working in three dimension, so this photon actually only have 1 degree of freedom. We can describe it using this scalar field sigma. The definition of sigma is here. A, the definition of A is F equal dA, and here F is du of d sigma. And this sigma is Gaussian boson from previous global U1 symmetry. Why we call it global U1 symmetry? Because you see here, this is a conserved current. We can write this current as a partial of sigma. We see if we add a constant to this scalar field, it's conserved. So the symmetry is actually a constant added to this field. It's invariant. So it is global U1 symmetry. I mean, the constant, it doesn't depend on the position. It doesn't depend on the location. And when A is smaller than zero, it's Higgs phase. The photon has mass, and U1 gauge symmetry is broken. Here, what's interesting here is, like, we have V, right? In standard model, we write V plus H over square root of 2. We can also find a vortex solution to this theory. So this one, sigma, can also create a vortex. I guess you might get lost somewhere, but let's summarize a little bit. We have an O2 model. We have a Billing-Higgs model. When A is larger than zero, we have a global U1 symmetry. We have a massive phi boson, and this is a conserved current. And on this side, when A is smaller than zero, we have a U1 global symmetry, and it has a vortex solution. Remember here, and here is a massive boson. We have the current, this one. So this current corresponding to this current, this is boson, and this is flux. So we interpret it as this vortex attached with a flux is a composite thing. This composite thing in this theory corresponding to the boson in this theory. And in this phase, when A is smaller than zero, we have this, like, rho. We have the massless Gaussian boson. We have the vortex solution. In this theory, we have a massless photon. We can describe it as a sigma. I mean, you see, they have the same name, So they are due to each other. And this one? And here we have the Masler's boson. Remember I told you the Masler's boson is logarithmically confined. But here, the vortex is also logarithmically confined. So somehow, they are very similar to each other.
Yeah. One question. Why are we comparing the two models but with different sign of A?
Ah, this A is A tilde. It's different A.
Okay.
And like we compare this way because they have similar like properties.
Right.
So we try to identify them. I don't think they are exactly the same, but they have the very similar physical properties. Yeah. So here comes to the definition of duality. I told you before, duality means two different theories that can give you this exactly the same physics, but actually it's not true for most of the dualities. Usually when we talk about duality, it means the IR duality, which means two theory can flow to the same IR point. The duality I told you before is actually one of the IR duality. So they are not dual. Only if you choose A equal to zero and flow to the IR point, you can show that they actually dual to each other. But even if they are not correct, but the physics are still similar to each other. This is one of the power of duality. And to show, for every duality, we want to know like whether these are true, whether the observable, whether the correlation function on both sides are equal, and whether they describe the same low energy physics. But as I said, it's really hard to prove it's true. And for most of this, like, although we believe they are true because they give us a lot of correct description of our phenomena, but they are not true. So there's a lot of work to be done here. This some more examples. The first one, this is chi is a fermion. Fermion coupled to some gauge field is due to another fermion coupled to a gauge field. So it's called fermion-fermion duality. This one is a fermion. It's a free fermion. It's only coupled to the background gauge field. It's due to a boson, which looks like interacting boson. So it's a fermion-boson duality. You can think of interacting boson in terms of a free fermion. All of the examples here are IR duality. And the third one is the boson-boson duality. This transformation we learned in kinetic matter is also an example of duality. It helps you remember, it helps you transform from interacting bosonic spin to free fermion, free Majorana fermion. Yeah. And so it's called fermionization. And if we somehow turn something into a boson, it's called bosonization. Yeah. It's actually the synonym of duality. And all of the example here can be incorporated as the larger family of duality. It's called level rank duality. Level, as I told you, is a coupling of Chern-Simons term. Rank is a number of Casimir operator. So it's related to this number here. So you see here, if UK with this coupling is due to the scalar with this thing, it looks like if you can just exchange the number here, K to be here and N to be here. So it's called level rank duality. And if you want something to take to home, like this is something you need to remember. This is famous statistical transmutation. It's called if you attach a flux to boson, you can show that the statistics is actually fermion. If you attach two flux, it's also a boson. And the other way around is also true. You can attach a fermion. It can attach a fermion with a flux. It turns to a boson. This one is a result in very recent paper by Wheaton and David Tong last year. And this is a like technique to help you derive more dualities. Suppose you have two theory which are dual, you assume they are dual. And you can apply a S transformation, which is you promote this background gauge field to a dynamical gauge field, then add this term. And this shows that this is a new duality. And T transformation is just add a new term here. The good thing is these two operations do not commute. So you can keep doing this, TSTS, TTS. You can generate infinitely many dualities. Any question here? This one is the duality known to children. Basically, it says if you turn electric field to magnetic field, and you turn magnetic field to manners of electric field, the whole theory doesn't change here. And if you have the source, you also need to exchange the magnetic charge and the electric charge. But this one is so simple. Usually, Panji people write it in a more complex way. But it's exactly the same thing. So if you have a Lagrangian here, and the kinetic term, and some new term here. And you can define a new coupling constant, theta over 2 pi. This is E, the coupling of field E. And you define F plus F minus this way. And this Lagrangian can be written in this way. It's very symmetric. And it's again Wheaton show that this theory is invariant under two transformations. You turn tau to tau prime equal to minus 1 over tau, and tau equal tau plus 1. These two transformations will make your theory invariant. And just like in CFT, we can write these two transformations in matrix, and it's called SL2Z. It's not as SL2C. And yeah. And in group theory, this can generate the whole family of SL2Z. And their claim is the electromagnetic theory is invariant under SL2Z operation. And you see here, we use the same name, S and T operation. This is 4 dimension, that is 3 dimension. They actually related together. And let me tell you why. As I said, in 4 dimension, we have very beautiful theory. We have theory, we add S operation or T operation, the theory doesn't change. What if our manifold has a boundary? This is a boundary. We have 4 dimension. This boundary has 3 dimension. If you are working Minkowski, the time direction lives on the boundary. We have the bulk field as before, and there may be some boundary degree of freedom coupled to the gauge field in the bulk. This is a boundary term, and this is the bulk term. Under some gauge duality transformation, maybe S, maybe or T, this thing, we may ask whether this theory is still invariant. The answer is no. You can turn to this theory, which are similar, but the boundary degree of freedom is changed. And how they are changed, the answer is given by Gaiuto and Wheaton in 2008. But basically, they are working in the supersymmetry in Qt for superyMLs, and they give how boundary conditions is transformed under S-duality. Why they are useful to us? We have a four-dimensional, very beautiful duality. The theory is invariant under this true operation. Then, if our theory has a boundary, the bulk theory is not invariant anymore. But if you somehow you change the boundary theory from A to B, like the whole theory is again invariant. But if you take tau equal to I infinity, what is tau? Tau is this thing. If tau is I infinity, which means E is zero, which means there is a coupling between your current and your gauge field. If E is zero, which means the boundary decouples with the bulk, we can get a purely three-dimensional theory from this four-dimensional thing. So we can link between the three-dimensional duality and the four-dimensional duality. This is basically the motivation of my Psi essay. So let me end my talk with Cyberg's quote. He said, duality is the unity of physics. These are a little, there are some applications of where you can find duality. Like in three-dimensional QFT, that basically the kinetic matter people are doing this. And in like ADS-CMT is trying to build some holographic model to study kinetic matter. And I mean, ADS-CMT is actually a ADS-CFT is again a duality. And mirror symmetry, which we will learn in string theory, is a supersymmetric version of S-duality. A particle vortex duality is the first duality I told you. And somehow you may wonder why we care about the half space. This thing is a half space. Physically, it's not, it doesn't make sense because we don't have a half space thing. You can have an interface to, like, or you can have a duality world, but it doesn't make sense to only have half space. But the point is, this ADS space is conformally equivalent to half space. So, like, in study this very simple Minkowski space, we can give some insight in ADS-FT. And this is a recent result in ADS-FT. From this, we get two different field theory. Then again, this two different field theory is due. So we can learn more about dualities. Yeah. Here is my reference. Any questions?
What if this possible? Like at the end of your talk, you says one theory is two different really. What is this possible
theory? I don't know. But this theory is still like two different theory. So we can make a connection between this 2-3D theory.
Is it you don't know or nobody knows it?
Oh, I don't know. I believe someone knows that. Maybe David.
Vasily
Abbas. Even I don't know. I just couldn't be. I just contribute to me.
And my side project is in the Witten's paper, they conjecture several dualities, which is a three-dimensional dualities. And it's just a conjecture. They don't know whether they are true or not. and we try to give some spot, support from the four-dimensional thing, the using the link, using the thing here. And because Davida is familiar with four-dimensional dualities, and using this, we can try to explain something about three-dimensional dualities.
Thank you.
Cool. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the research that I've done with Amit Sever in Tel Aviv before I came here. Basically, I'm going to discuss some symmetries that were conjectured to be global symmetries, although they originate from the gauge symmetry. Specifically, I'm going to talk about QED, but this is this subject is interesting also in linear as GR, and actually in all GR and in all quantum gravity, any quantum gravity in flat space, and also well asymptotic flat space, and also in QCD or anywhere that you. Okay, so. Okay, so usually we call large gauge symmetries, as Dan said today in lecture, symmetries that are not connected to the unity.
Oh, okay.
And in this case, it's not completely correct, actually, to use the word large, but Strominger coined it, and people use it, and it's that's what people call it. It has poles, so in this sense, it's not connected to the unity. I'll get to the definition and you'll see. So BMS is a symmetry, and the asymptotic symmetries of GR in flat space. Large gauge transformations, LGT, is the infinite dimensional set of symmetries that is analogous to that in QED. Okay. So I'm just going to state the black hole information paradox is the problem that we see. But from GR, we know that black holes don't have any information on the outside. I mean, the radiation from black holes is thermal. All you can infer is the mass of the black hole and charge of the black hole. And I don't know. Spin and stuff, I don't care. And the thing is that these symmetries were conjectured to be maybe, not conjectured. There's an idea that maybe these symmetries can admit charges that can partially solve this problem. So is this a new hope, or can this new conserved charge store information? I'm going to claim that no. I'm going to give some reasons, and you can think whatever you want. So let's start, symmetries. Consider a U1 gauge symmetry, a scalar particle just for so that it's simple. So we have Poincaré symmetry. What do we know? We know that momentum is conserved, and we know that the amplitude is a function of the invariance, right? The Mandelstam invariance. We have frame independence. We have global U1 symmetry, electric charge conservation. We know that the incoming charge and the outgoing charge are the same. This is how, do I have a thing here? This is how a global gauge U1 transformation looks. Okay. Now, large gauge transformation. Are there global symmetries? They are the residual gauge transformations that are allowed by our gauge choice. For example, we make a gauge choice, Lorentz gauge. We have d mu of a equals 0, right? Can we add a total derivative to a? Yeah, if we add a total derivative, we're still with 0. So usually what we do to solve this, we have we fix the gauge and we still have some gauge freedom. What we do to solve it, we say at infinity, a is 0. That makes sense, right? And if at infinity a is equal to 0, and we try to look at the transformation at infinity, and we want it to stay 0, then d lambda is 0, so lambda is a constant, right? So if lambda is a constant, then Let's say we're looking at lambdas that are analytic functions at infinity. It's a constant. It's a constant. It's an analytic function. What am I trying to say? It's a constant, then it's the global U1 transformation. Okay. Now, what we do to allow the large gauge transformation is relax this. We say A can have some value. I mean, we know that at infinity, the electric field has to go to zero at some rate, because we can enlarge the sphere. And then it has to go to zero like inverse R squared. But A can go to zero at any way that allows the electric charge to go to zero appropriately, because it's only a gauge field. So we relax the condition. That admits a vacuous space. Why does it admit a vacuous space? Because we have a lot of configurations of A that are the same. So we have a large vacuous space, a large space of parameterization of A that are the vacuum, and we treat them differently now, because we don't force A to be zero. Now, we cannot tunnel between these spaces, because if we start doing perturbation theory, we have infinities that exponentiate and tell us that the probability of tunneling between these vacua is zero. This is actually related to something we already learned. It's related to the IR infinities, to the IR divergences. IR divergences generally are actually zeros. We have zero probability of not emitting a very, very soft particle. We have some divergence at pre-level. We have some at loop level, for example. We have some divergences in the perturbation series. But if we exponentiate the perturbation series, we see that these are actually e to the minus infinity, which means we have zero probability of some tunneling. And this is actually the tunneling from vacua to vacua. And soon we will see, when I choose the correct states to scatter, I don't get the IR divergences anymore. And the reason that I don't get the IR divergences is that I'm not trying to move from one vacua to the other. I'm correctly parameterizing the vacua under the state in both sides so that I can scatter under the same vacuum. So I will use null coordinates. These are the coordinates that I choose. Z is just the coordinate on the sphere at infinity. These are projective coordinates. U is defined like that. What happens is that if we draw the Penrose diagram, R goes like this, and U is at the sort of time coordinate. Large gauge transformation, now I can define them. They are parameterized by an arbitrary function on that sphere. The sphere, every point here is a sphere, and I'm parameterizing the large gauge transformation by an arbitrary function on that instead of going to zero. Okay. Now you can, by definition, see the commutation relation of that with the field. Let's see. This is the action on a photon. You can see that this transformation changes only zero energy photons by definition. The reason is, if we look at this plot again, the function that parameterizes it is the same over all of this thing. This means that we are integrating out at constant over all time in a way, which means we are taking only the zero energy component of the transformation. Taking only the zero energy component of a gauge transformation means we're changing the gauge field only for zero energy particles. On the other hand, for matter particles, charged particles, we see that the change is dependent on is the electric field flux through infinity of that specific particle. You can see that I'm integrating over this function, parameterizing the transformation, and this is the expression for the electric field of the particle. So, for example, I can choose a delta function, and I'm measuring the electric field through some specific angle, or I can choose some other distribution. And what's interesting is that I can choose this function arbitrarily. So if I try to interpret this as some charge that is conserved right away, I would say that it's conservation of angular charge. But we know that that's not true. So this thing is a little bit harder to interpret than it seems. So we see that the large gauge transformation of a bare particle, we will soon see what is a not bare particle, depends on its relativistic speed. Okay. Now, I'm going to make a small jump to Weinberg soft photon theorem. The reason that I'm talking about Weinberg soft photon theorem is that this this charge that we, that the conservation of this charge is actually equivalent to this statement, the soft photon theorem statement. You have an amplitude on one side and an amplitude one particle less, one photon less on the other. And when you take the extra photon here to be very soft, very low energy, this thing is correct. The large gauge transformation generator, the generator of the transformation, factorizes into a soft part and a hard part. And we can actually see when we calculate this thing is that the hard part measures this thing, which is actually the proportional to the electric field. And the soft part is an operator that adds one soft photon. So the conservation of charge is the statement that adding one photon is equivalent to adding this thing that measures the electric field in the correct direction, in the direction the photon is coming from. So this is a statement by Strominger that started all of this fashion, all of this trend, that the soft theorem is actually the word identity of an infinite dimensional asymptotic symmetry group. The asymptotic symmetry group is the large gauge transformation. It's infinite dimensional because I can choose an arbitrary function on the sphere. And this is very interesting because soft theorems are a way to start knowing things about amplitude. Because if we know the first order of the expansion, then we can start understanding the next order. Now let's talk about IR safety. We said before that we have IR divergences, and we see that these are closely related to the large gauge transformation. If we want to understand anything physical about the amplitudes, and the large gauge transformations are equivalent to the soft theorem, we have to understand how amplitudes that are IR safe behave. So IR divergences, they arise from the masslessness of photons. The textbook treatment is just to regularize. For example, add some minimal energy for the photon, some mass. And then when we calculate the cross-section, after we calculated all of the amplitudes and took the diffraction between the amplitude, we calculate the cross-section. And then we can take the regulator to zero. We can take the photon mass to zero. And we have some strong theorems promising us that this will be finite after we take it to zero. The problem is that although is enough for most phenomenological purposes, if we are going to talk about the S matrix and about its unitarity, we need to work in a framework where it's well-defined. So the second resolution is to regulate at the level of the Hamiltonian. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the electrons that are coming into into the scattering, and we're going to say they are not far enough not to interact. That's the reason that we have a problem. And we cannot take them far enough not to interact because of the long-range interactions because of the masslessness of the photons and hence the long range of the Coulomb interaction. So we're going to include the one over R terms in the expansion of the Hamiltonian when we solve for the bare states. What do we mean? What do I mean by that? Instead of scattering free states, instead of scattering plane waves, we're going to scatter solutions of a different Hamiltonian. We're going to say the interacting Hamiltonian, when the particles are very far, is similar enough to something that is not completely not interacting. Another interpretation of these states that we will find when we do this is that they have some well-defined electric field at infinity. And we're going to see that this is very, very related to the question that we raised before. And the thing that happens when you do quantization in this way is that you have to choose the boundary conditions on your Hilbert space. Although the Hilbert space is infinite, you have to state what is the electric field that penetrates infinity at every angle. Now, this is the definition of these asymptotic states. They are just states, the regular Fock states, which are just plane waves. And we add some operator that acts on them and adds this soft photon cloud. which is the correction of the state. This is just technical.
What does RF depend on?
So RF, what do you mean? Okay. Yeah. You have a dependence on P. You have a row here, which is this. This function has one parameter that we can fix. We have the freedom to fix one parameter. If we demand that these states are well defined, we have the freedom to fix one parameter. This parameter is equivalent to the electric field at infinity. So we can choose this C however we like, but we have to choose it in a way that the total flux out of at infinity will be appropriate for the amount of charge that we have. Okay, but that's the only thing that we have to satisfy. So let's calculate the large gauge transformation, large gauge charge of some process. These are incoming electrons. This is the dressing, the cloud of photons. You can see the photons. And this is the charge just acting on an outgoing state. We can see that we have an action on the vacuum, an action on the dressing, and an action on the bare particles. We know the action on the bare particles and on the vacuum. Here we get some soft particle. And here we get the soft factor from the soft theorem. That's the only question that we need to answer is how it acts on the dressing. But the soft particle, in the presence of the dressing, we can do some perturbative calculation. That's actually more of a demonstration, because it's not important to understand this for the end result. But this is a demonstration of how perturbation theory changes in the presence of these clouds. You can see that the soft particle, the incoming soft particle, also connects to the cloud, because the cloud has soft particles as well. So it can be annihilated by an annihilation operator from the cloud. We get exactly the same factor that cancels the soft factor of the soft theorem. So overall, we see that this charge acting on the vacuum, creating a soft particle, actually now vanishes inside the scattering matrix. Now, we can use the transformation properties of A to find the transformation of this whole cloud. And we can see that it depends only on C. What does it mean that it depends apart from... Okay. It depends on C and has a part that is exactly the opposite of the soft factor that we will get from the hard particle, from the other particles. So overall, when we calculate the charge inside the scattering process, we can see that its expectation value is exactly that field at infinity that we defined, that we said that we have the freedom to set. So what do we have? We get a conservation of that field at infinity. This is actually something that we have a very classical and easy interpretation for. Let's say we have some process. We have some incoming particles. We have some outgoing particles. We have some black hole forming here and some bad stuff happening. Now, I'm going to neglect the fact that black hole forming here does not necessarily mean that I can have asymptotically flat spacetime, but I'm going to assume asymptotically flat spacetime because that's the only. If there's no asymptotic flat spacetime, all of this discussion is not valid. So I have particles coming in, I have particles coming out, and I have some electric field here. Now this is infinity. This is decoupled completely from the physics. So the statement of the conservation is something like, if I have a charge and it's very far away from the black hole, and I have nothing else in the universe, and I have some process here, the charge stays the same. That's
if the charge is further away.
Is further away. It's completely decoupled. It's
but it's even further away than the infinity.
This is the charge is at infinity, obviously. Let me try it.
So we just compactify it and say that infinity is a place and or the infinity is the boundary, and this is like a boundary theory.
I'll try to be more precise. I have some particles going into a process. I'm not drawing infinity, to be careful. I have some electric field lines coming out of this setting of particles. I have some process happening here. I'm measuring stuff here and here. I'm not measuring the incoming, I'm measuring the outgoing here. Because I measured it after some finite time, I have some finite space that I can affect. This conservation is actually the conservation of the electric field lines outside of my causal future. Which means that if I have new particles here that are different from the ones before, but obviously they sum to the same charge, close by I will see the electric field lines. I will see the electric field lines that are appropriate for the relativistic speed of these particles because they are pretty far away from each other. But if I look far away enough, the change of this thing from this pattern will not have arrived to where I'm looking. So I always have some location. I can go always far enough so that the information of the fact that the setting of particle has changed, that the particle content has changed its momenta or changed its distribution of charge, has not arrived yet to that place. So this is actually, in my interpretation, and I think, and I hope that this is convincing. If not, we can talk about this later if any of you want. In my interpretation, this is the equivalent. This is equivalent to this classical statement that you can always go far enough. This can be demonstrated for a single particle. If I take a single particle and I change its speed instantaneously, then I will have something like this for its electric charge. There will be a distance for which the information of the change of speed didn't get yet. So the electric charge looks as if it continued in its previous speed. Okay, I'm going to try to finish because I'm over time as it is. So this charge is measuring everything outside the arena. It's measuring everything outside of the scattering process. And there has to be something, because if you have charge in some closed, well, that's another discussion. I don't know yet. So you can draw this dressing as some Wilson lines at infinity, which explains why they make you invariant under gauge transformation, because Wilson lines change the way you transform. And these Wilson lines take all of the particles to transform as if they were localized at the same place, so they cancel each other's transformations. So the charge is independent of the momenta or any other quantum numbers. So we want higher finiteness, so we respect some boundary conditions on the electric field. Gauge invariance means that we have the same boundary conditions for ingoing and outgoing states. So if we have some different electric total flux, it restricts something about the state. But if we have different distribution of the electric fields, it can still bend to accommodate particles of different speeds. In a way, what I showed you was ways to construct different particle content with the same field at infinity. So we have a trivial conservation of the charge. So even if we can measure this, it tells us only about the Cs that we choose. It tells us only about what happens outside the arena, nothing about what actually was the matter content. Large gauge transformation, this is the summary. Large gauge transformation act trivially on the physical asymptotic states. They only preserve something that is preserved trivially when you treat the electric field at infinity correctly. The supertranslations are expected to be the same. Supertranslation is the picture, the same thing, but for gravity. Information paradox can be formulated in this. You can use these states to formulate information paradox. You can say I have a Hilbert space of these states, and you still get the information paradox, in the same extent. So there's no way that this moving that this can be a solution, because in this framework it's trivial. There is an idea that some combination of super rotation and super translations is going to help solve the information paradox in some way, but I don't understand what super rotations are, so I'm not going to talk about this. And okay, future directions you can read or talk to me. I don't want to waste more of some other people's time.
How do you apply this to GR?
So there's a paper, relatively recent paper, applying this these states to linearized.
Or what does it mean?
To linearized, yeah. Sorry, what?
What does it mean, or what does it give when we apply this to GR?
Okay, so we get some kind of, for every incoming particles with some energy, you'd have a cloud of soft gravitons around it. You can interpret this as particle. It's just the usual IR explanation. You have particles very far away, they still have some interaction, some gravitational interaction between them. There's no meaningful difference in interpretation. For Young Mills, it's very hard quantum Young Mills is very hard to explain this thing. Basically, the idea is that when a particle goes to zero energy, you want it to be decoupled from the physics, because you are at whatever process you're dealing with it in a finite space. And when you are going to the question of what happens in infinite space, you always get zero. These are the IR divergences. You always get the answer is always zero. And in a way, you have to even when you do the traditional thing of handling this with a IR cutoff in a cross section, you still need to add some resolution of the collider, for example. So you always have to somehow give a cutoff of the lowest energy available. So this is just a way to do that at the amplitude level. In a sense, it's just summing over different amplitudes that are gauge equivalent.
Another question. Why do you relate black hole horizon to IR? In which sense is the horizon infrared?
So I didn't really have time and I didn't want to go into that. Maybe I should have softened down the black hole talk. But the idea is that you're taking a scattering process and assuming that they're formed and evaporated the black hole in the middle of some. If you go far enough, you get, for example, you have some kind of thing, GR black hole. And if the assumption is that if you go far enough, it will evaporate and you will go back to flat space. That's not necessarily true. But to discuss the implications of S matrices in flat space and black holes, you have to assume that you can have a process of this kind.
So you say evaporation of the black hole is an infrared limit.
Okay, no. So the reason that I'm talking about infrared is because...
Because we take the radius of the black hole to zero.
Because we go very far away. And the thing is that I'm not talking about scattering only for infrared particles, but I'm saying I need to, because this conserved charge is an IR charge. This conserved charge is a transformation that acts the same on all of these things. Because it acts the same on all of these things, it creates IR particles, and it measures the Coulomb part of the potential, which is the most long-range part of the potential of the electric field of the other particles. So this conservation is an IR effect, not specifically the black hole. And we want to see what it means for a black hole, but that's the reason that we have to use a framework that treats IR appropriately to see what this thing is, what the statement of conservation is.
No one asks a question, I will ask another one.
Sure.
At some point, it seemed to me that you are like you are giving a proof for holography, because you say there are charges on the boundary. I will call infinity the boundary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's the boundary.
Behave like the normal physics. So it's like boundary duality, a kind of.
So this is one of the, as you can see, this is one of the so-called future future directions. I think now Strominger and people at Harvard are working hard on taking these charges and defining boundary theories. This is also in Young Mills. These charges, you look at the at the conserved currents, and they are exactly they have exactly the algebra of a Kac-Moody current. So it's very convenient to define a CFT on the sphere at infinity. Will it be a completely holographic definition of theories in 4D? Probably not. You don't have enough degrees of freedom even, but maybe. If you look at the amount of information that you can store in a CFT or in a Hilbert space of a 4D theory, you don't have enough information theoretically. But I don't know. There have been some very good papers in the last few years trying and succeeding to do this to some extent. There is a good paper by Skinner and I don't remember the name of the other person, where they define a CFT from the sphere at infinity to complexified null infinity that reproduces all of the three amplitudes of gravity, and they do it also for Young Mills. So it's very interesting. It's relatively technical, but it's very interesting that you can do it. And if there is a boundary theory, it has to respect these symmetries. So yeah, the other thing that I think is interesting is that the way I define the IR safe amplitudes is one way, where you cut out some. You cut out some portion of your configuration space. You say, I give an IR cutoff for the photons. But there's another way which cuts off just the pole at zero. And people treat them as equivalent, treated them as equivalent for a long time now. And I think that if you cut off the pole at zero, you have amplitudes. For example, I don't know how many of you know MHV amplitudes for Young Mills, for example. The only pole that you have in the pole structure is the soft pole. So if you cut out this pole, intuitively I would say that these amplitudes should vanish, all of them. And if all of the MHV amplitudes vanish, then by the construction of other whole gluon amplitudes, a pure gluonic three-level amplitudes, all of them should vanish. And I don't know, if that is somehow compatible with what we can measure, and if it is compatible with all of the amplitudes that we, all of the cross sections that we measure, then maybe it's interesting. I was thinking about it, but it's too many calculations. So, okay, I'm done.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about holographic entanglement entropy in ADS-CFT, and I'm going to keep it pretty basic, so I apologize if everyone knows all this already. So what I'll do, oh wait, is there a way to click through these, or do I just have to click on my computer? Oh dear.
Thanks, Nick. It's not yours anymore.
Okay. So I'm just going to give a brief overview of entanglement entropy in general, and then I'll relate this to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy for a black hole. And I'll introduce the ADS-CFT correspondence in order to relate these, and then I will introduce the Ryu and Takayanagi prescription, and I'll talk about some properties of entanglement entropy, and then I'll finish with relating this to what I have been doing. Okay, so entanglement entropy. So as we all know, entanglement entropy measures correlations in quantum systems. And so if we have a system, say in a lattice, we can split it into two areas, A and B, and find the entanglement entropy of system A with respect to system B by this formula. Get the stick. This von Neumann formula here, which we're all familiar with from our quantum theory course. And those of us taking the condensed matter course are also familiar with the area law of entanglement entropy. So if you do this for the ground state of the system, you find that the entanglement entropy is proportional to the boundary of the system A. So this dA, the entangling surface, you'll find the entropy is proportional to that, which is interesting because thermodynamically, we'd expect entropy to be proportional to the volume. But in this case, this isn't true. So you can move this onto a continuum case in a CFD. I just do the same thing. So you take a constant time slice or a Cauchy surface in the CFD. But then when you try and compute the entanglement entropy, you'll find that it turns out to be infinite. And this is because there are some short range correlations that take over at the actual entangling surface. So to actually compute anything, you need to regulate these infinities with a cutoff, a UV cutoff epsilon. And then we find that we recover the area law dependence in the entanglement entropy. And to the leading order in the cutoff, in the regulator, it's given by the area over epsilon to the d minus 2.
D is the space-time dimension.
Yes, sorry, D is the space-time dimension.
And epsilon is just
a cutoff that you can choose.
All for the space.
Yeah. So the answer that you compute is going to be dependent on your regulator, but there are some universal terms that appear in the expansion that you can use to get universal information about your quantum field theory. And then there's another area of physics where entropy also obeys an area law, and that's in the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy for, Nick.
Yeah, about the former slides. You're calculating an entanglement entropy in the quantum field theory, right? How exactly do you do that? Because on the lattice, there are certain steps that you do that are not that trivial to put on a quantum field theory. Like, for one, you have to split your Hilbert space into two pieces.
Yeah, so when you split, so when you introduce this entangling surface, you have to choose which points are in A and which are in B, and that is not... Sometimes it's going to be arbitrary, and two people doing this calculation will get different answers.
Okay. And then,
So there's no correlations measured on scales shorter than your cutoff epsilon.
Okay.
Yeah. So then for the... So black hole entropy also has this area law, so... The Bekenstein-Hawking formula for the entropy is that it's the entropy of a black hole is proportional to the horizon area over 4. And this connection between the entanglement entropy formula and the black hole area formula, where they both have an area law, led people to speculate that they were connected. And Raphael Sorkin in 1983 suggested that perhaps entanglement entropy is the origin of black hole entropy. So now we have these two. We have these two similar formulae, and we're looking for a way to relate them. And we all know from Alvarez's talk last week that there is a well-known way to do this, the ADS-CFD correspondence. So this correspondence relates a theory of gravity in D plus one dimensions to a quantum field theory in D dimensions. And more specifically, you have a gravitational theory in ADS space, which is dual to a conformal field theory on its boundary. So So those of us taking the cosmology course are aware that ADS space is just a space of constant negative curvature. So it looks something like this. So it's kind of like the Minkowski equivalent of a hyperboloid. And then it has a boundary that can be conformal to, say, Minkowski space. And then if you want to describe the ground state of a quantum system, this is going to be dual to your vacuum ADS space. But then the excited and thermal states are dual to more interesting spaces. So perhaps if you put a black hole in your ADS space, you can describe an excited state. So for example, here we have two metrics describing ADS space. They're both equivalent. So they have a boundary at first one at or equals infinity. You can see here that it's conformal to Minkowski space. And this is where your CFD can be described. And then you can put a black hole in your space. And then this describes an excited state. So that's just an example of a metric. So it's dual to a thermal state on the boundary. And we find that the entropy of the black hole is actually dual to the thermal entropy on the CFD. So if we want a way to describe the entanglement entropy, we can't use the black hole entropy. To describe the entanglement entropy, we need to turn to Ryo and Takinagi, who in 2006 gave a holographic prescription for computing the entanglement entropy. So as before, we just take our system, our CFT, and we take a constant time slice. And then we want to construct a surface that stretches into the bulk space. So that's the surface there I've drawn. And you want this to be the surface of extremal area. And then if you compute the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of this surface, so just the area divided by 4, you'll get the entanglement entropy on the CFT. But as you recall, I said the entanglement entropy was actually infinite. So this is also infinite, so you must introduce a cutoff again, this time an IR cutoff. And you'll find that the divergences in this or not cutoff exactly match the epsilon divergences if you choose your or not appropriately. So if you choose or not, so L is the ADS length scale, the curvature. And so if you choose your cutoff like that, the divergences will be the same.
Delta?
Pardon?
What is delta?
Sorry, that's meant to be an epsilon. Epsilon, you're in cutoff from before. That epsilon. And that was my mistake. So just to be more explicit, you build your extremal surface and then you compute its area. But instead of integrating the area to infinity, you have to introduce your cutoff and you only integrate your area to there. Because otherwise you'll get infinite area. And why does this work? So this was just conjectured in 2006, but it's passed a number of consistency tests. So the first obvious one is that it reproduces the area law, which is what we were looking for in the first place. And then you can actually calculate the entanglement entropy in D equals 2 CFDs. And so say this boundary circle here is your CFT, and the center is the bulk. You can construct your extremal surface, which is just a geodesic. And you can compute the length of that, the length of that will give you your entanglement entropy, and they match exactly. So that's a really important consistency check. And then for a pure state, you want the entanglement entropy of one area to be equal to the entanglement entropy of the other area, its complement. So we can see here that this is trivially true, because if you construct an extremal surface for one, it'll be the same as the extremal surface for the other. For a thermal state, it's more complicated because you have to put in a black hole. So here, the entropies will differ because you have, so the extremal surface has to be homologous to the area you're computing the entanglement entropy for, which just means that it can be shrunk down to the area. So in this case, if you're computing the entanglement entropy of A, you'll use this extremal surface here. It can't go around the black hole. Whereas for A prime, you'll use this larger one so that it can be shrunk down to A prime. So these are some reasons that are clues that perhaps we are doing the right thing. Okay, so I'm just going to talk about some properties of entanglement entropy and how they relate to the bulk. So, for example, we have the first law of entanglement. So if you have some state, you can always write it as e to the minus h over the partition function, and h is known as the modular Hamiltonian. It's just some Hermitian matrix. And if you perturb this state, so if you take rho naught and take it to rho naught plus delta rho, you will find that to linear order in the perturbation, the change in the expectation value of this modular Hamiltonian is equal to the change of the entropy. And this looks very much like the first law of thermodynamics. And in fact, if you have a thermal state, the modular Hamiltonian is just given by h over t, and this becomes the first law of thermodynamics. And if you extend this into the bulk, it can be shown that these actually imply the linearized Einstein equations, yeah?
What makes a modular Hamiltonian modular?
It's just the name of it. It's like it's called the entanglement Hamiltonian as well sometimes in the literature.
And how do you find it?
It's a complicated thing, and it's difficult to find in general. They have expressions for it in some cases, so they can write it in, I think, Rindler space. They have an exact, they know what it is, but in general, it's difficult to work with, which is why this correspondence is actually useful, because it's difficult to compute a lot of these things in the case of the conformal field theory, and it's easier to work with them sometimes in the bulk. So in the case where they are able to write an expression for the modular Hamiltonian, they can use this to map into the bulk and derive the linearized Einstein equations for them. So essentially, what they're saying is that when you make this perturbation, the space-time to which, so when you perturb your CFT, your quantum field theory, the space-time will also be perturbed. And this just shows that it'll be perturbed to a space-time which satisfies the linearized Einstein equations. Okay, so I'll just move on to how this relates to what I've been doing. So there are certain black holes that can display this sort of phase transition behavior in the temperature entropy plane. So if you see here, we have this kind of oscillatory van der Waals behavior. And so if you then construct, if you look at the boundary of this space, and you look at this surface of constant shape and area, and you compute, so as you change, so this is, as you change the area of your black hole, you are just changing the size of your black hole, so you are perturbing your quantum field theory on the boundary. So if you compute the entanglement entropy for a surface of constant shape, it was found that this also kind of mimics the space behavior, like that. So a feature of this is that, so if this is the, so here we have three branches of black holes and only two of them are stable, this one, this one, and it's found that as you increase the temperature, you go up this, it's exactly analogous to the van der Waals gas. You go up this branch, and then at a certain critical temperature, you'll just go straight across, and you'll go up here. And as in the case of the van der Waals gas, there's an equal area law here. So this area here is equal to this area here when the phase transition agrees. And there are people looking to see if this is also true in the case of the holographic entanglement entropy. So whether this area here equals this area here, or if this happens at a different temperature, and if this can use to be to define perhaps an entanglement temperature. So hopefully I'll be able to look at that a bit during my work for my essay. And so thank you very much. Here are some of my sources. And thank you for listening. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you.